Hello there. My name is Stephen Rumford, and I'm the host of the Life and Death podcast, brought to you by Ashgate Hospice. This is a series in which we have honest conversations about life, death, bereavement, and so much more. I've worked in palliative care for more than 20 years, and in this series I sit down with a host of different people to discuss their experiences of death, dying, and bereavement, in order to get a deeper understanding of what life and death means to them. After the success of the first and second series, as well as a Christmas special last year, we are delighted to be back with our third series. In this episode, I'm joined by Clover Stroud, a writer and journalist who regularly contributes to national newspapers, including the likes of the Sunday Times and The Guardian. Clover's beloved sister Nell died in 2019, aged just 46, after being diagnosed with breast cancer. Just days before, doctors had told Nell that she had years to live. Following on from her Sunday Times bestseller, My Wild and Sleepless Nights, A Mother's Story, her latest release, The Red of My Blood, tells the story of Clover's journey during the first year after her sister's death. I'm delighted to be joined with her on the Life and Death podcast.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
So the book was released back in March, I believe, of this year.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Earlier on, when we were just chatting before we'd started recording, you were saying that you'd been at various book events. I just wondered, how's the book, you know, you're there seeing your audience in those events, I guess. And I just wonder, how's the book been received? What's your sense of it out there in the world?
So the book is a very, very confessional take on the first year of grief, really. My take on dealing with my sister's death it runs really from the day of her death to the first anniversary. And I describe in detail what that felt like for me and the kind of path I walked. And what has been really lovely about doing these events and meeting people is seeing how the book is affecting them and how I have sort of put words and described something which is often kind of thought of as a beyond words experience. And I really, really love meeting people at events and sharing my story with them, and often them sharing their story with me. And it's really, really made me aware of how much in this country, you know, we have a kind of tradition really of not talking about death and grief and bereavement being in a place which is sort of private. It's a private family matter. It's often kind of described as that. And what I'm noticing is a kind of real sense of relief from people when I meet them in, you know, literary festivals and bookshops. I've done two different bookshops this week. Is this kind of relief, at being able to describe what their pain, what their memories, what their joy, what's been surprising, what's been challenging. And I think that my book has kind of put into words things that they have felt. And I've had the most like incredible reactions, and also via my social media, because I'm very active on Instagram. I love talking to people there. People saying, oh my goodness, like my mum died 7 years ago, but your book has helped me understand what I was really going through then, which I couldn't remember, or I didn't want to remember, or I was suppressed or forgotten. And it feels like a real honour for me, and kind of the reason why I write basically is to connect with other human beings through this difficult and strange and beautiful and confusing process of being a human being and being alive and dealing with all the stuff that we deal with. I mean, in answer to your question, it's been really, really wonderful to see how people have responded, and this sense of relief and joy in being able to articulate and talk about something which we don't like talking about. Mm.
I mean, you absolutely do capture, I think particularly that the first chapter, the sort of sense of confusion and discombobulation that occurs when you do find yourself entering a grief state when there is such extreme loss. So I'm not surprised that that does connect. I mean, it certainly did for me. That was certainly the first thing that struck me, was just how familiar, you know, you took me back to losses of my own straight away. So, yes, I can imagine that's meeting a lot of positive connections for people out there, positive in the sense of meaningful or real. I don't mean joyous, but I mean positive in real.
That's what I want, that kind of raw authenticity. That's what I'm aiming for in my life. That's the way that I kind of like to live, if I can, to have that. And to be able to do it through my writing is a really, really incredible experience. And I think that when my sister died, I had experienced grief before because my mum died in 2013. So I had been through grief before. I had experienced it. I knew the kind of strange madness, exhilaration, exhaustion, confusion it brings with it. And yet when Nell died, probably because she was only 46 as well, so there was a sense of like the wrongness, the out of time of her death. And I felt so terrified by what I was feeling, which was, you know, you talk about the first chapter, that I really, really tried to articulate that kind of confusion, that separation from the rest of the world, that almost hallucinogenic quality of where on earth is the rest of the world? Who am I in the world? What are these feelings? And I was very scared by grief and the feeling of where it would take me. And was I going to have a breakdown? Was I going to lose my mind and not regain my mind? Was this the kind of life that I had forever? Was it always going to feel like this? And that was a real motivation in writing, was to try and understand what happens. And I really remember looking at other friends who've suffered a lot of loss in their lives, and I remember looking at them and thinking, well, they look like they're alive. They've lost a lot of people in terrible circumstances. I know the details of that. So what are they doing? How have they got to that place? And how do I get from the place that I am in now, which feels completely undone and completely broken? And how do I go on living my life and being a mum? I've got 5 children, so I've got a lot of demands on me. How do I go on living that life, which I value so much, whilst also dealing with this really, really, really massive loss? And it was kind of, I'm a journalist. I was a journalist for 20 years before I wrote my first book, The Wild Other, which was about my mum and dealing with the loss of her through her accident. And so I am interested in observing people as well and why we do things. And I'm really interested in, you know, so-called normal people. I love hearing other people's stories, is maybe why I love doing these events as well, because I love hearing real life stuff, not the kind of stuff of celebrity and Hollywood and all that jazz. That doesn't really interest me. I want to know your story, you know. I want to know the stories of real people, and that's where we can learn and grow and help each other, I think.
For sure. Did you manage to glean anything from these friends in terms of kind of techniques, if you like, or a methodology to stop things fall apart, the centre cannot hold?
Yeah.
This notion that something goes and then it just hurtles out from this stable state. What did you learn, do you think, in terms of methods or means of trying to keep a hold of all of these different bits, if that makes sense?
Well, watching them, they were all smoking cigarettes really heavily and drinking wine. And I thought, for a bit, I thought, well, that looks quite fun in a way, actually. Maybe I'm going to do that. And that was in the immediate aftermath, which I think is really normal as well. I started smoking again, which I had given up ages before. I found real kind of comfort, honestly, in drinking some red wine and sort of being able to vanish. But from talking to other people, and I talked to a good friend of mine called Liv, whose mum had died, she just said it will get better. And when it was really, really bad, like the knowledge that it will get better at some point and you have to keep moving on through it, and you can't speed it up, you can't hasten it. There are no, when I was looking at those friends at that lunch, I was thinking, you know, what are they doing? Is there some kind of trick that I can copy to get this pain away? And actually there's no fast way through it. I really do think that time is an incredibly helpful thing. And for me, the thing that I have found that's kind of helped me, which I love talking about, is an idea that death and grief transforms your life in a way that you don't want. And to start with, you resist it. You want to go back to where the beloved person is. You know, I'd want the sky to open and her to appear as a big hologram. I'd want to hear a booming voice. I want there to be like a clap of thunder or a huge rainbow suddenly appear. And obviously, you know, unfortunately, those things don't happen. I couldn't hear her voice. And it was, facing that is so, so hard. And like accepting the reality of the person you love is dead. And I still find that, you know, it still really hits you. And I think that will always, you know, however long I live, who knows how long our lifetimes will be, but I think that will always be there. but a feeling of learning how to kind of live with a sense of her around. And in the way that I live, I'm trying to kind of honour her, I'm trying to celebrate her, I'm trying to connect with her, I'm trying to feel a sense of her. And I guess I'm really interested by the way grief can be a kind of creative act. And if we find the thing that we love, for me it was being outside with horses, but I have so much kind of respect and awe really when you look at other human beings and the losses that we deal with and the incredible things that people do. And like, you live with this, what feels at first like unendurable loss, and you know, people run marathons or set up charities or start doing incredible embroideries. And I think that when we can try and accept that there is a strange, and it's very difficult to articulate, there is a strange gift that comes with death as well, you know, it's a gift you don't want to be given to start with, you just don't want it. Is a difficult thing to do, but it really transforms your life as well. And for me, that gift has been a kind of greater understanding and desire to nurture and respect my creativity as well. And I think that we all really have that in us if we want it. And that's been a surprising and beautiful thing.
Could you give us a kind of word image? I know that's ridiculous, and I'm not expecting you to contain the whole of Nell in some words, but could you bring her into the podcast a little bit?
Sure, yeah. Nell was 2 years older than me, and we grew up in a kind of, with the youngest of five children with much older siblings. I mean, I look back on it as a really, really, really idyllic, really beautiful time. I feel really lucky and really privileged to have had a lot of love from my parents. And I think that that really was something that helped Nell and I so much dealing with mum's accident. We had been really, really loved. And I think it's so important for kids to have that base. And we were really encouraged to, we had a really liberal upbringing where we were encouraged to spend a lot of time outdoors. But she was always really obsessed by circus since she was really small. So after university, when she went off and bought a van and went off and lived with travelling circuses, like making popcorn, riding horses, and then graduating to become a ring mistress, I wasn't particularly surprised by this. Although other people, you know, it was quite a out there thing to be doing, to be living in this little van. And like, she was always on the south coast and I'd go and visit her, and it was beautiful, really. And then she started her own circus in 2000. And Nell was an artist. She had an artist's mentality and an artist's drive. She was very into and obsessed by her own creativity and her own self-expression. And like, sometimes I felt like she was a foot taller than me. She wasn't a foot taller than me, but she was like a big, blonde, actually incredibly serious, could be quite difficult, funny, unusual person. And nobody who met her would forget her. She was a bit like a warrior or something like that. She was very, very striking physically. And because she was such a big personality as well, and such a big kind of force of nature, I mean, it was really fun. It was really, really fun and exciting and maddening and brilliant to be her sister.
Great. I've got a very, very good image of her now. That's really, really helpful. So she was diagnosed with breast cancer. If we just talk about that journey in terms of the diagnosis, and then I'm particularly struck, and it really is a small, you know, sidebar that I started with in the intro there, about going from a position of being given, you know, a reasonable length of time in terms of her prognosis from her oncologist to her death being so sudden. I wonder if you could, if you don't mind, just saying a little bit maybe about that process from diagnosis and how that was received, and then particular that point of you have years to live, and then the time being so brutally short.
So she was diagnosed in 2015 and she had quite bad cancer at that stage. It was, you know, it was unfortunately, tragically caught quite late. And she had chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And then she had a sort of brief break, and then she developed cancer on the other side as well. She went to see a private oncologist actually at that point, and he had her on new drugs, and he was really positive and felt that he was doing what he was, which was to hold the cancer at bay, and he was achieving that. And 10 days before she died, he'd seen her and he'd said, like, you have like at least 5 years and maybe 10 years to live. And then she got a small problem with her lung and she went into hospital, but she was still told, no, she'll be out in a few days' time. It was just a, you know, brief period of time that she was in hospital for. It was early December 2019. I talked to her. She said, oh, yeah, I'm going to pull through this and I'll be out soon. And the next morning, he said, come to the hospital. You have to come immediately. And when I got to the hospital, which is about an hour's drive from here in Gloucester, he said, she's got a day to live. And the actual reality of dealing with that, I think I'm still kind of trying to understand that. Yeah. And that feeling of the absolutely kind of pounding inevitability of death, of not being able to do anything at all, there being no hope, there being no line that you could walk towards. It was going to come, you know, within a matter of hours. And that was, there's dealing with the loss of Nell. And then sometimes I think there's also the actual magnitude and solemnity and horror and also beauty of being there at her death. She had a really, and I'm grateful for this, she had a really beautiful death with her family around her. It was very quick and there wasn't very much time to have the conversations, but people who loved her were there. But processing that and that feeling of like death arriving in the room, and I do really feel as though, and I write about this in the book as well, this feeling of death coming and being a presence that was going to take her away. And we're used to sort of, yeah, being able to steer things in the way that we want. And then death is so, undoes everything, you know, because you just can't, because when it's there, there's nothing that you can do. And so the acceptance of that is very hard and scary and also awe-inspiring, because it does inspire awe because of the finality of it. Because it reminds you that, like, this is the way that we are all going. You and me, we're going in that direction. Everybody that we love is going in that direction. The only thing that we don't know is, like, how fast the journey is to that place. And I think being reminded of that, and I've definitely tried to bring this into my life with my children as a mother, for example, having conversations like this, around death and loss is so, so important, because we don't want to talk about it and therefore we are really unprepared for it. But in a way, a death and when it happens is as part of our lives as going on holiday together. And we talk about our holidays and plan those, but we don't talk about our death and what might happen. And I think it will be, if there has been conversations and the kind of familiarity, I suppose, with the language and the ideas, I hope that will make it easier. I mean, I think it will make things easier.
I agree. I often think about that. I think the thing with death is it's such a discontinuity that in a way it's hard to prepare for that in some ways. There's an image by a chap called Krishnamurti, who is a sort of Indian mystic, I guess. Someone asks him what death is like. And he said, if you just imagine taking the most precious thing you have and dropping it. And it is that kind of sudden discontinuity.
Yeah.
And what I think one can prepare, I think there is something about a kind of culture of preparedness. It is shocking because your brain has got used to them being there and then they're not there. And that's just shocking. But somehow you've created a culture of openness and communication that probably do help that grieving process, I suspect. Yeah, I mean, none of it's great, right? None of it's great, but I think there are ways that we could do it better, which is what you were alluding to, I think, at the beginning, about you wanting to be part of an ongoing conversation or a more open frame to that conversation. It's just better that we are open about this rather than stuffing it under the carpet all the time.
I think so, yeah. I think that when we do that, we're just kind of hiding the pain. And obviously I'm like very, very open about pain and loss, but in being open you kind of have an opportunity to feel it.
Yes, it doesn't go away by being quiet, does it? It's not that you stop feeling grief and hurt and pain. You don't avoid it. It's not, no one gets away with it, you know. It's just how you manage it. Just aware that all of this happened during lockdown.
There was a really strange experience, and people often describe this when somebody they love has died before a major world experience, kind of global shared experience, which was that you have a sense of like they existed in a world that was so different. So when the pandemic happened, partly I felt really annoyed as well, because I really wanted to talk to her about what this, at the time, you know, felt like almost apocalyptic circumstances, what she would have done. And so that was very kind of another thing that I felt frustrated and angry about, was I would just like to have talked to her about this. And then there was the strange experience of being in a bereaved state and going through that first year whilst I couldn't really be with the rest of the world. And I was, you know, spending a lot of time at home with the children and with my husband. And we all were in that state in one way or another, you know, locked in at home. I think I found it quite consoling not having to be part of the outside world and be at home with the kids and my husband, who I really love. It was actually suited me quite well at that time. And then there was a strange thing of when will we get back to normal, was something that many people were talking about. And there is a strange thing of when you lose somebody that you want everything to stop, to acknowledge the solemnity and how massive your loss is. And the weird thing was the world did stop. And I was also aware of this conversation about when are we going to go back to normal? And everybody was talking about when is normal going to return? And it really helped me to understand that in grieving and bereavement, that going backwards to that place, and this is what we started the conversation with, isn't really possible, and that I had to evolve. I couldn't just go back to the life I had before with all its frustrations and irritations and periods of, you know, normal human depression and anxiety and all that stuff. I had to change. I had to evolve. I had to like create this feeling of something different happening. And that could be, for some people, that might be something really tangible. For me, this was this like feeling of my creativity and understanding more about my creativity and wanting to use my creativity as a sort of refuge and form of expression. That was really the new normal that I was creating in the future, rather than going back to the place I was in before. And I think that the probably lockdown might have contributed to this feeling of being in a sort of vortex and writing in that vortex. I think it helped my writing actually in some way or another. It gave it a kind of immediacy and ferocity and colour. And I hope this conversation has kind of communicated that. And what I write about in the book is, it's called A Death and Life Story. And I want to try and feel it for myself and communicate to other people this sense of the colour of loss and the brightness of loss and the kind of gift of it. And we talked about this earlier, the strange gift of death. And it's a horrible gift to have to accept. You know, you don't want to accept it at all, but it is there to be taken if you can kind of get there. And I hope I communicate as well a kind of sense of awe at life and love for other human beings. The beauty of that in an odd kind of way. You know, we really, really see, we see one another as humans with all of our human pain and all of our human suffering when we are present to one another's losses. And I think like being human with each other is about the most important thing you can do, like being that kind of sense of humanity and compassion and love and equalness as well. I think it kind of brings it brings that into your consciousness in a powerful way.
It certainly contains all of those things. I think you've done a marvelous thing. I think it's a real gift, actually.
Thank you.
You know, because I think you're right, there is something that we're gifted. I think there's some wisdom that we're gifted. I think there's a sense of understanding about our scale and our place and our duties that are incumbent on that we get through going through grief. And also I think there's an incredible strength, and that again comes through. So it's like you've repackaged, you've re-gifted, yes. Which of course are the best gifts, right? Re-gifting. You've re-gifted something of that in a way that the readers will be able to take without a doubt, without a doubt. I'm grateful for the book, and I'm grateful for what you've done by writing it, actually. Please, you know, people go out and read the book, not just to buy the book, but to read the book, to be affected by the book, to be made more human by it in a way. So I think you've achieved it, would be my sense as a reader. You definitely got there.
I really like what you say about kind of re-gifting death, the experience of death. The reason that I wanted to write it as well, because I wanted to read a book which helped me understand what I was going through and like feel less scared and appalled and confused by it. And there are many books about grief which describe it as a and they all look dark, muted, grey experience. And my experience of it was not that. It was colourful. It was painful. It was like a load of pinballs going off of pain and anger and awe. And, you know, there is hilarious stuff that goes on, as sort of the ridiculous stuff that goes on it as well. And that's what I wanted to communicate. So it's lovely to hear that it has resonated so much. And I hope it will help people.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. You know, it can't help but, I don't think. I wonder, Clover, whether, you know, given all that you've been through, is there anything that you would say by way of thoughts for those that are maybe going through it or will be going through grief? Is there any, I don't mean top tips, but I sort of do mean top tips, like, you know, ways to manage?
I mean, I think the thing that I possibly found hardest was the sense of the loneliness of grief. It was lonely even going through it whilst living with my husband and children, because, and I'm close to all of them, but nobody can feel the stuff that you have to feel. Nobody can, and I use a kind of metaphor for going into a dark forest that is full of brambles and a snaking path. You don't know where you're going. You're getting lost. You have to go through that, and nobody can live through that emotional experience for you. So I think you can feel very lonely, but I suppose what I would really like to communicate to people is that you are not alone at all, and that you are experiencing something which we all will experience, and that when you lose somebody you love, you kind of join. I've described it before as like a sort of silent, I'm going to have a very strong image in my mind of like a silent throng of people walking across a massive plain, and you at some point, I feel emotional talking about this, you join them, and you have many, many people walking beside you who've gone through it as well. And they might not be visible, but they absolutely are around you. And I think to kind of put out your hand and seek those people, because we do want to connect and we do want to support. And I think that you can feel as though your pain is unendurable, you can feel as though it's absolutely unique to you, and you will have your own unique kind of pain. I'm not belittling that in any way at all, but to know that there are many people walking around you who are also carrying their own unique pain, and that together, you know, by sharing the stories, by putting those hands out and taking other people's hands, the path is easier, you know, and we kind of walk together through it. That's what I would try and communicate, really, was the shared sense of being a human. That's what's helped me most of all, and I hope that would help other people.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us, Clover, and thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in to the Life and Death podcast. If you've been affected by anything you've heard in this episode, you can head to our website, ashgatehospice.org.uk, where there is an array of resources to support people who are experiencing grief and bereavement. If you've enjoyed this episode in our third series, please do let us know. You can rate us and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, and you can subscribe wherever it is you get your podcasts. We'd love you to ask us any questions or share your experiences of death and dying in your review, or let us know on social media by searching for us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.